Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert A. Heinlein continued. Cassette 7, Side 1. Mike was interested in the disgusting picture. He grokked, theoretically, what the letter and picture symbolized, and studied the picture with the delight with which he studied each butterfly. He found butterflies and women tremendously interesting. All the grokking world was enchanting, and he wanted to drink so deep that his own grokking would be perfect. He understood the mechanical and biological processes being offered in these letters, but wondered why strangers wanted his help in quickening eggs. Mike knew, without grokking, that these people made ritual of this necessity, a growing closer, somewhat like water ceremony. He was eager to grok it. But he was not in a hurry. Hurry, he failed to grok. He was sensitive to correct timing, but with Martian approach. Timing was accomplished by waiting. He noticed that his human brothers lacked his discrimination of time and often were forced to wait faster than a Martian would. But he did not hold their awkwardness against them. He learned to wait faster to cover their lack. He sometimes waited faster so efficiently that a human would have concluded that he was hurrying at breakneck speed. He accepted Jill's edict that he was not to reply to these brotherly offers from female humans, but accepted it as a waiting. Possibly a century hence would be better. In any case, now was not the time, since his brother Jill spoke rightly. Mike agreed when Jill suggested that he give this picture to Duke. He would have anyhow. Mike had seen Duke's collection, looked through it with interest, trying to grok why Duke said, "That one ain't much in the face, but look at those legs."
"Brother!"
It made Mike feel good to be called brother by one of his own. But legs were legs, save that his people had three each while humans had only two. Without being crippled, he reminded himself. As for faces, Jubal had the most beautiful face Mike had ever seen, distinctly his own. These human females in Duke's picture collection could hardly be said to have faces. All young human females had the same face. How could it be otherwise? He had never had trouble recognizing Jill's face. She was the first woman he had ever seen and his first female water brother. Mike knew every pore on her nose, every incipient wrinkle in her face, and had praised each one in happy meditation. But while he now knew Anne from Dorcas, and Dorcas from Miriam, by faces, it had not been so at first. Mike had distinguished by size and coloration, and by voice, since voices were never alike. When, as sometimes did happen, all three females were quiet at once, it was well that Anne was so much bigger, Dorcas so small, and that Miriam, bigger than Dorcas, but smaller than Anne, nevertheless need not be mistaken for another if Anne or Dorcas was absent, because Miriam had hair called red, even though it was not the color called red when speaking of anything but hair. Mike knew that every English word held more than one meaning. It was a fact one got used to, just as the sameness of girl faces one could get used to. And after waiting, they were no longer the same. Mike now could call up Anne's face and count the pores in her nose as readily as Jill's. In essence, even an egg was uniquely self, different from all other eggs, anywhere and when. So each girl had potentially her own face, no matter how small the difference. Mike gave the picture to Duke and was warmed by Duke's pleasure. Mike was not depriving himself. He could see it in his mind whenever he wished. Even the face, as it had glowed with an unusual expression of beautiful pain. He accepted Duke's thanks and went happily back to his mail. Mike did not share Jubal's annoyance at the postal avalanche. He reveled in it. Insurance ads and marriage proposals. His trip to the palace had opened his eyes to enormous variety in this world, and he resolved to grok it all. It would take centuries, and he must grow and grow and grow, but he was in no hurry. He grokked that eternity and the ever-beautifully changing now were identical. He decided not to reread the Encyclopedia Britannica. Mail gave him brighter glimpses of the world. He read it, grokked what he could, remembered the rest for contemplation while the household slept. He was beginning, he thought, to grok business, buying, selling, and related on Martian activities. The encyclopedia had left him unfilled, as he now grokked. Each article had assumed that he knew things that he did not. There arrived in the mail from Secretary General Joseph Edgerton Douglas a checkbook and papers. His brother Jubal took pains to explain what money was and how it was used. Mike failed to understand, even though Jubal showed him how to make out a check, gave him money in exchange for it, taught him to count it. Then suddenly, with grokking so blinding that he trembled, he understood money. These pretty pictures and bright medallions were not money. They were symbols for an idea which spread through these people, all through their world. But things were not money, any more than water shared was growing closer. Money was an idea, as abstract as an old one's thoughts. Money was a great structured symbol for balancing and healing and growing closer. Mike was dazzled with the magnificent beauty of money. The flow and change and countermarching of symbols was beautiful in small, reminding him of games taught nestlings to encourage them to reason and grow. But it was the totality that dazzled him, an entire world reflected in one dynamic symbol structure. Mike then grokked that the old ones of this race were very old indeed to have composed such beauty. He wished humbly to be allowed to meet one. Jubal encouraged him to spend money, and Mike did so, with the timid eagerness of a bride being brought to bed. Jubal suggested that he buy presents for friends, and Jill helped, starting by placing limits, one per friend, and a total cost, not even a reciprocal filled three of the sum in his account. Mike had intended to spend all. He learned how difficult it was to spend money. There were so many things, all wonderful and incomprehensible. Surrounded by catalogues from Marshall Field's and the Ginza, Bombay and Copenhagen, he felt smothered in riches. Even the Sears and Montgomery catalog was too much. Jill helped. No, Duke would not want a tractor. Duke likes tractors. He's got one, or Jubal has, which is the same thing. He might like one of those cute little Belgian unicycles. He could take it apart and put it together all day long. But even that is too expensive. Mike, dear, a present ought not to be expensive, unless you are trying to get a girl to marry you, or something. A present should show that you consider that person's tastes, something he would enjoy but probably would not buy.
How?
That's the problem. Wait, I just remembered something in this morning's mail. She was back quickly. Found it! Listen to this. Living Aphrodite, a deluxe album of feminine beauty in gorgeous stereo color by the world's greatest artists of the camera. Notice this item cannot be mailed. Orders cannot be accepted from addresses in the following states. Pennsylvania's on the list. But we'll find a way. For if I know Duke's tastes, this is what he likes. It was delivered via SS patrol car. And the next ad boasted, as supplied to the man from Mars by special appointment. Which pleased Mike and annoyed Jill. Picking a present for Jubal stumped Jill. What does one buy for a man who has everything he wants that money can buy? Three wishes, the fountain that Ponce de Leon failed to find, oil for his ancient bones, or one golden day of youth? Jubal had long forsworn pets because he outlived them, or, worse yet, it was now possible that a pet would outlive him, be orphaned. They consulted others. Shucks, Duke told them. Didn't you know? The boss likes statues.
Really?
Jill answered. I don't see any sculpture around. The stuff he likes mostly isn't for sale. He says the crud they make nowadays looks like disaster in a junkyard. Any idiot with a blowtorch and astigmatism calls himself a sculptor. Anne nodded.
Duke is right. You can tell by looking at books in Jubal's study.
Anne picked out three books as bearing evidence, to her eyes, of having been looked at most often.
Hmm,
she said.
The boss likes anything by Rodin.
Mike, if you could buy one of these, which would you pick? Here's a pretty one, Eternal Springtime. Mike glanced at it and turned pages. This one.
What?
Jill shuddered.
Mike, that's dreadful. I hope I die long before I look like that.
That is beauty, Mike said firmly.
Mike,
Jill protested. You've got a depraved taste. You're worse than Duke. Ordinarily, such a rebuke, especially from Jill, would shut Mike up, force him to spend the night in trying to grok his fault. But in this he was sure of himself. The portrayed figure felt like a breath of home. Although it pictured a human woman,
It gave him a feeling that a Martian old one should be near, responsible for its creation. "It is beauty," he insisted. "She has her own face. I grok."
"Chill," Anne said slowly. "Mike is right."
"Huh?
Anne? Surely you don't like that?"
"It frightens me. But the book falls open in three places. This page has been handled more than the other two. This other one, the caryatid fallen under her stone, Jubal looks at almost as often. But Mike's choice is Jubal's pet."
"I buy it," Mike said decisively.
Anne telephoned the Rodin Museum in Paris, and only Gallic gallantry kept them from laughing.
"Sell? One of the master's works, my dear lady? They are not only not for sale, but may not be reproduced. Non, 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 quelle idée!"
But for the man from Mars, unlikely things are possible. Anne called Bradley. 2 days later, he called back. As a compliment from the French government, with a request that the present never be exhibited, Mike would receive a full-size, microscopically exact bronze photopantogram of She Who Used to Be the Beautiful Aulmière. Jill helped select presents for the girls, but when Mike asked what he should buy for her, she insisted that he not buy anything. Mike was beginning to realize that while Warner Brothers spoke rightly, sometimes they spoke more rightly than others. He consulted Anne.
"She has to tell you that, dear, but you give her a present anyhow."
"Hmm."
Anne selected one which puzzled him. Jill already smelled the way Jill should smell. When the present arrived, its size and apparent unimportance added to his misgivings. And when Anne had him with it before giving it to Jill, Mike was more in doubt than ever. The odor was very strong and not at all like Jill. Jill was delighted with the perfume and insisted on kissing him at once. In kissing her, he grokked that this gift was what she wanted and that it made them grow closer. When she wore it at dinner that night, he discovered that in some unclear fashion, it made Jill smell more deliciously Jill than ever. Still stranger, it caused Dorcas to kiss him and whisper, "Mycon, the negligee is just lovely, but perhaps someday you'll give me perfume."
Mike could not grok why Dorcas would want it. Dorcas did not smell like Jill, so perfume would not be proper for her. Nor would he want Dorcas to smell like Jill. He wanted Dorcas to smell like Dorcas. Jubal interrupted.
"Quit nuzzling the lad and let him eat. Dorcas, you reek like a Marseille cat house. Don't wheedle Mike for more, stinkum."
"Boss, mind your own business."
It was puzzling that Jill could smell still more like Jill, but Dorcas should wish to smell like Jill when she smelled like herself. That Jubal would say that Dorcas smelled like a cat. There was a cat on the place, not a pet, but co-owner. On occasion, it came to the house and deigned to accept a handout. The cat and Mike grokked each other. Mike found its carnivorous thoughts most pleasing and quite Martian. He discovered that the cat's name, Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche, was not the cat's name, but he had not told anyone because he could not pronounce the cat's real name. He could only hear it in his head. The cat did not smell like Dorcas. Giving presents was a great goodness and taught Mike the true value of money. But he did not forget other things he was eager to grok. Jubal put off Senator Boone twice without mentioning it, and Mike did not notice. His grasp of time made next Sunday no particular date. But the next invitation came addressed to Mike. Boone was under pressure from Supreme Bishop Digby and sensed that Harshaw was stalling. Mike took it to Jubal.
"Well," Jubal growled, "do you want to go? You don't have to. We can tell him to go to hell."
A checker cab with a human pilot, Harshaw refused to trust a robo-cab, called next Sunday morning to deliver Mike, Jill, and Jubal to the Archangel Foster Tabernacle of the Church of the New Revelation. Chapter 23. All the way to church, Jubal was trying to warn Mike. Of what, Mike was not certain. He listened. But the landscape tugged for attention. He compromised by storing what Jubal said.
"Look, boy," Jubal admonished, "these Fosterites are after your money and the prestige of having the man from Mars join their church. They'll work on you. You'll have to be firm."
"Beg pardon?"
"Damn it, you're not listening."
"I am sorry, Jubal."
"Well, Look at it this way. Religion is a solace to many, and it is conceivable that some religion somewhere is ultimate truth. But being religious is often a form of conceit. The faith in which I was brought up assured me that I was better than other people. I was saved, they were damned. We were in a state of grace, and the rest were heathens. By heathen, they meant such as our brother Mahmud. Ignorant louts who seldom bathed and planted corn by the moon claimed to know the fine lances of the universe that entitled them to look down on outsiders. Our hymns were loaded with arrogance, self-congratulation on how cozy we were with the Almighty and what high opinion he had of us. What hell everybody else would catch some judgment day. We peddled the only authentic brand of Lydia Pinkham's...
Jubal,
Jill protested. He doesn't grok it. Sorry. My folks tried to make a preacher of me. I guess it shows.
It does.
Don't scoff, girl. It would have made a good one if I hadn't fallen into the fatal folly of reading. With a touch more confidence and a liberal helping of ignorance, I would have been a famous evangelist. Shucks, this place we're headed for would be known as Archangel Jubal Tabernacle. Jill shuddered.
Jubal, please. Not so soon after breakfast.
I mean it. A confidence man knows he's lying. That limits his scope. But a successful shaman believes what he says, and belief is contagious. There's no limit to his scope. But I lacked the necessary confidence in my own infallibility. I could never become a prophet, just a critic. A sort of fourth-rate prophet with delusions of gender.
Jubal frowned.
That's what worries me about false rites, Jill. I think they are sincere. Mike is a sucker for sincerity.
What do you think they'll try to do?
Convert him. Then get the hands on his fortune.
I thought you had things fixed so that nobody could.
No, just so that nobody can grab it against his will. Ordinarily, he couldn't give it away without the government stepping in. But giving it to a politically powerful church is another matter.
I don't see why.
Jubal scowled.
My dear, religion is a null area in the law. A church can do anything any organization can do, and has no restrictions. It pays no taxes, need not publish records, is effectively immune to search, inspection, or control. And a church is anything that calls itself a church. Attempts have been made to distinguish between real religions entitled to immunities and cults. It can't be done short of establishing a state religion, a cure worse than the disease. Both under what's left of the United States Constitution and under the Treaty of Federation, all churches are equally immune, especially if they swing a block of votes. If Mike is converted to Fosterism and makes a will in favor of his church, then... goes to heaven, some sunrise. It will be in the correct tautology, as legal as church on Sunday.
Oh, dear, I thought we had him safe at last.
There's no safety this side of the grave.
Well, what are you going to do, Jubal?
Nothing. Just fret.
Mike stored their conversation without trying to grok it. He recognized the subject as one of utter simplicity in his own language, but amazingly slippery in English. Since his failure to achieve mutual grokking, even with his brother Mahmud, through imperfect translation of the all-embracing Martian concept as Thou Art God, he had waited. Waiting would fructify at its time. His brother Jill was learning his language, and he would explain it to her. They would grok together. Senator Boone met them at the Tabernacle's landing flat.
Howdy, folks. May the good Lord bless you this beautiful Sabbath. Mr. Smith, I'm happy to see you again.
And you too, Doctor.
He took his cigar out of his mouth and looked at Jill.
And this little lady, didn't I see you at the palace?
Yes, Senator. I'm Jillian Boardman.
Thought so, my dear. Are you saved?
I guess not, Senator.
It's never too late. We'll be happy to have you attend Seeker Service in the Outer Tabernacle. I'll find a guardian to guide you. Mr. Smith and the Doc will be going into the sanctuary. Senator.
What, Doc?
If Miss Baldwin can't go into the sanctuary, we had better attend Seeker's service. She's his nurse.
Boone looked perturbed.
Is he ill?
Jubal shrugged.
As his physician, I prefer to have a nurse with us. Mr. Smith is not acclimated to this planet.
Why don't you ask him? Mike, do you want Jill with you?
Yes, Jubal.
But... Very well, Mr. Smith.
Boone again removed his cigar, put fingers between his lips, and whistled.
Cherub here!
A youngster in his teens came dashing up. He was dressed in short full robe, tight slippers, and pigeon's wings. He had golden curls and a sunny smile. Jill thought he was as cute as a ginger ale ad.
Boone ordered, "Fly up to the sanctum office and tell the warden on duty that I want another pilgrim's badge at the sanctuary gate right away. The word is Mars."
"Mars," the kid repeated, threw Boone a scout salute, and made a 60-foot leap over the crowd. Jill realized why the robe looked bulky. It concealed a jump harness.
"Have to watch those badges," Boone remarked. "Be surprised how many sinners would like to sample God's joy without having their sins washed away. We'll mosey along and sightsee while we wait for the third badge."
They pushed through the crowd and entered the tabernacle into a long, high hall. Boone stopped.
"I want you to notice, there is salesmanship in everything, even the Lord's work. Any tourist, whether he attends Seeker's service or not, and services run 24 hours a day, has to come through here. What does he see? These happy chances."
Boone waved at slot machines lining both walls.
"The bar and quick lunch is at the far end. He can't even get a drink without running this gauntlet. I tell you, it's a remarkable sinner who gets that far without shedding his change. But we don't take his money and give him nothing. Take a look."
Boone shouldered his way to a machine, tapped the woman playing it.
"Please, daughter."
She looked up. Annoyance changed to a smile.
"Certainly, Bishop."
"Bless you. You'll note," Boone went on as he fed a quarter into the machine, "that whether it pays off in worldly goods or not, a sinner is rewarded with a blessing and a souvenir text."
The machine stopped. Lined up in the window was, "God, watches, you."
"That pays 3 for 1,
Boone said, and fished the payoff out of the receptacle.
"And here's your text."
He tore off a paper tab and handed it to Jill.
"Keep it, little lady, and ponder it."
Jill sneaked a glance before putting it into her purse. "But the sinner's belly is filled with filth." NR 22:17.
"You'll note," Boone went on, "that the payoff is tokens, not cash, and the bursar's cage is back past the bar. Plenty of opportunity there to make love offerings for charity and other good works, so the sinner probably feeds them back in, with a blessing each time, and another text. The cumulative effect is tremendous. Why, some of our most faithful sheep got their start right in this room." "I don't doubt it,"
agreed Jubal.
"Especially if they hit a jackpot. You understand, every combination is a blessing, but the jackpot, that's the three holy eyes. I tell you, when they see those eyes lined up and staring at them, all that manna from heaven coming down, it really makes them think. Sometimes they faint. Here, Mr. Smith."
Boone offered Mike one of the tokens.
"Give it a whirl."
Mike hesitated. Jubal took the token himself. Damn it, he didn't want the boy hooked by a one-armed bandit.
"I'll try it, Senator."
He fed the machine. Mike had extended his time sense a little and was feeling around inside the machine, trying to discover what it did. He was too timid to play it himself. But when Jubal did so, Mike watched the cylinders spin, noted the eye pictured on each, and wondered what this jackpot was. The word had three meanings, so far as he knew. None of them seemed to apply. Without intending to cause excitement, he slowed and stopped each wheel so that the eyes looked out through the window. A bell tolled, a choir sang hosannas, the machine lighted up and started spewing slugs. Boone looked delighted.
"Well, bless you, Doc, this is your day. Here, put one back to take the jackpot off."
He picked up one of the flood and fed it back in. Mike was wondering why this was happening, so he lined up the eyes again. Events repeated, save that the flood was a trickle. Boone stared.
"Well, I'll be blessed. It's not supposed to hit twice in a row. But I'll see that you're paid on both."
Quickly, he put a slug back in. Mike still wanted to see why this was a jackpot. The eyes lined up again. Boone stared. Jill squeezed Mike's hand and whispered, "Mike, stop it."
"But Jill," I was saying,
"don't talk, just stop. Oh, wait till I get you home."
Boone said slowly,
"I'd hesitate to call this a miracle. Probably needs a repairman." He shouted, "Cherub here," and added, "We'd better take the last one off anyhow,"
and fed in another slug. Without Mike's intercession, the wheels slowed down and announced, "Foster loves you." A cherub came up and said,
"Happy day. You need help?"
"3 jackpots," Boone told him.
"3?
Didn't you hear the music? Are you deaf? We'll be at the bar. Fetch the money here and have somebody check this machine.
Yes, Bishop.
Boone hurried them to the bar.
Gotta get you out of here, he said jovially, before you bankrupt the church.
Doc, are you always that lucky?
Always,
Harshaw said solemnly. He told himself that he did not know that the boy had anything to do with it. But he wished that this ordeal were over.
Boone took them to a counter marked reserved and said,
This'll do. Or would the little lady like to sit?
This is fine.
And you call me little lady once more and I'll turn Mike loose on you. A bartender hurried up.
Happy day, your usual bishop. Double. Will it be, Doc? And Mr. Smith, don't be bashful. You're the supreme bishop's guests.
Brandy, thank you. Water on the side.
Brandy, thank you, Mike repeated, and added, No water for me, please. Water was not the essence. Nevertheless, he did not wish to drink water here.
That's the spirit, Boone said heartily. That's the spirit with spirits, no water. Get it? It's a joke.
He dug Jubal in the ribs.
What'll it be for the little lady? Cola, milk for your rosy cheeks, or a real happy day drink with the big folks?
Senator, Jill said carefully, would your hospitality extend to a martini?
Would it? Best martinis in the world. We don't use vermouth, we bless them instead. Double martini for the little lady. Bless you, son, and make it fast. We've time for a quick one, then pay our respects to Archangel Foster and on into the sanctuary to hear the Supreme Bishop.
The drinks arrived, and the jackpot's payoff. They drank with Boone's blessing. Then he wrangled over the $300, insisting that all prizes belong to Jubal. Jubal settled it by depositing it all in a love offering bowl. Boone nodded approvingly.
That's a mark of grace, Doc. We'll save you yet. Another round, folks.
Jill hoped that someone would say yes. The gin was watered, but it was starting a flame of tolerance in her middle. Nobody spoke up, so Boone led them away, up a flight, past a sign reading, Positively no seekers nor sinners. This means you. Beyond was a gate. Boone said to it,
Bishop Boone and three pilgrims, guests of the Supreme Bishop.
The gate opened. He led them around a curved passage into a room. It was large, luxurious in a style that reminded Jill of undertaker's parlors, but was filled with cheerful music. The theme was jingle bells with a Congo beat added. Jill found that it made her want to dance. The far wall was glass, and appeared to be not even that. Boone said briskly,
Here we are, folks, in the presence. You don't have to kneel, but do so if it makes you feel better. Most pilgrims do. And there he is, just as he was when he was called up to heaven.
Boone gestured with his cigar.
Don't he look natural? Preserved by a miracle, flesh incorruptible. That's the very chair he used when he wrote his messages. And that's the pose he was in when he went to heaven. He's never been moved. We built the tabernacle right around him. Removing the old church, naturally, and preserving its sacred stones.
Facing them, about 20 feet away, seated in a chair remarkably like a throne, was an old man. He looked as if he were alive. And he reminded Jill of an old goat on the farm where she had spent childhood summers. Outthrust lower lip, the whiskers, the fierce brooding eyes. Jill felt her skin prickle. Archangel Foster made her uneasy. Mike said in Martian, My brother, this is an old one. I don't know, Mike. They say he is. He answered,
I do not grok an old one.
I don't know, I tell you.
I grok wrongness.
Mike, remember?
Yes, Jill.
Boone said,
What's he saying, little lady? What was your question, Mr. Smith?
Jill said quickly, It wasn't anything, Senator. Can I get out of here? I feel faint. She glanced at the corpse. Billowing clouds were above it. One shaft of light cut through and sought out the face. As lighting changed, the face seemed to change. The eyes seemed bright and alive.
Boone said soothingly,
It has that effect first time.
You ought to try the Seeker's Gallery below us, looking up and with different music, heavy music with subsonics, I believe it is. Reminds them of their sins. Now this room is a happy thoughts meditation chamber for high officials of the church. I come here and sit and smoke a cigar if I'm feeling a bit low.
Please, Senator.
Oh, certainly. Wait outside, my dear. Mr. Smith, you stay as long as you like.
Jubal said,
"Senator, hadn't we best get on into the services?"
They left. Jill was shaking. She had been scared silly that Mike might do something to that grisly exhibit. Get them all lynched. Two guards thrust crossed spears in their path at the portal of the sanctuary. Boone said reprovingly,
"Come, come, these pilgrims are the Supreme Bishop's personal guests. Where are their badges?"
Badges were produced, and with them, door prize numbers. A respectful usher said, "This way, Bishop," and led them up wide stairs to a center box facing the stage. Boone stood back.
"You first, little lady?"
Boone wanted to sit next to Mike. Harshaw won, and Mike sat between Jill and Jubal with Boone on the aisle. The box was luxurious, self-adjusting seats, ashtrays, drop tables for refreshments. They were above the congregation and less than 100 feet from the altar. In front of it, a young priest was warming up the crowd, shuffling to music and shoving heavily muscled arms back and forth, fists clenched. His strong bass voice joined the choir from time to time. Then he would lift it in exhortation.
"Up off your behinds. Gonna let the devil catch you napping."
A snake dance was weaving down the right aisle, across in front and back up the center aisle, feet stomping in time with the priest's piston-like jabs and the syncopated chant of the choir. Clump, clump, moan. Clump, clump, moan. Jill felt the beat and realized sheepishly that it would be fun to get into that dance, as more and more people were doing under the brawny young priest's taunts.
"That boy's a comer," Boone said approvingly.
"I've team preached with him, and I can testify he turns the crowd over to you sizzling. Reverend Jug Jackerman used to play left tackle for the Rams. You've seen him?"
"I'm afraid not," Jubal admitted. "I don't follow football."
"Really? Why, during the season, most of the faithful stay after services, eat lunch in their pews, and watch the game. The wall behind the altar slides away, and you're looking into the biggest stereo tank ever built. Puts the plays right in your lap. Better reception than you get at home. And it's more thrill with the crowd around you."
He whistled.
"Cherub, over here."
Their usher hurried over. "Yes, Bishop?"
"Son, you ran away so fast I didn't have time to put in my order."
"I'm sorry, Bishop."
"Being sorry won't get you into heaven. Get happy, son. Get that old spring into your step and stay on your toes. Same thing all around, folks?"
He gave the order and added,
"Bring me a handful of my cigars. See the chief barkeep."
"Right away, Bishop."
"Bless you, son. Hold it."
The snake dance was about to pass under them. Boone leaned over, made a megaphone of his hands, and cut through the noise.
"Dawn! Hey, Dawn!"
A woman looked up. He beckoned to her. She smiled.
"Add a whiskey sour to that.
Fly."
The woman showed up quickly, as did the drinks. Boone swung a seat out of the back row for her.
"Folks, meet Miss Dawn Ardent. My dear, that's Miss Boardman, the little lady down in the corner. And this is the famous Dr. Jubal Harshaw here by me."
"Really, Doctor? I think your stories are simply divine."
"Thank you."
"Oh, I do. I put one of your tapes on and let it lull me to sleep almost every night."
"Higher praise a writer cannot expect," Jubal said with a straight face.
"That's enough, Dawn," put in Boone. "The young man between them is Mr. Valentine Smith, the man from Mars."
Her eyes got big.
"Oh, my goodness."
Boone roared.
"Bless you, child, I really snuck up on you."
She said,
"Are you really the man from Mars?"
"Yes, Miss Dawn Ardent."
"Just call me Dawn." "Oh, goodness."
Boone patted her hand.
"Don't you know it's a sin to doubt the word of a bishop? My dear, how would you like to help lead the man from Mars to the light?"
"Oh, I'd love it."
"You would, you sleek bitch," Jill said to herself. She had been growing angry ever since Miss Ardent joined them. The woman's dress was long-sleeved, high-necked, and opaque, and covered nothing. It was a knit fabric the shade of her tanned skin, and Jill was certain that skin was all there was under it, other than Miss Ardent, which was plenty. The dress was ostentatiously modest compared with the clothes of most females in the congregation, some of whom seemed about to jounce out. Jill thought that Miss Ardent looked as if she had just wiggled out of bed and was anxious to crawl back in. With Mike. "Quit squirming your carcass at him, you cheap hussy." Boone said,
"I'll speak to the Supreme Bishop, my dear. Now get back and lead that parade. Jug needs you."
"Yes, Bishop. Pleased to meet you, Doctor, and Miss Broad. I hope I'll see you again, Mr. Smith. I'll pray for you."
She undulated away.
A fine girl, that, Boone said happily. Ever catch her act, Doc?
I think not. What does she do?
You don't know?
No.
Didn't you hear her name? That's Dawn Ardent. She's the highest paid peeler in all Baja California, that's who. Works under an irised spot, and by the time she's down to her shoes, the light is just on her face, and you really can't see anything else. Very effective. Highly spiritual. Would you believe, looking at that sweet face now, that she used to be a most immoral woman?
I can't believe it.
Well, she was. Ask her. She'll tell you. Better yet, come to a cleansing for seekers.
I'll let you know when she's going to be on.
When she confesses, it gives other women courage to tell their sins. She doesn't hold back. It does her good, too, to know she's helping people. Very dedicated. Flies up every Saturday night after her last show to teach Sunday school. She teaches the young man's happiness class, and attendance has tripled since she took over.
I can believe that,
Jubal agreed.
How old are these lucky young men?
Boone laughed.
You're not fooling me, you old devil. Somebody told you the motto of Dawn's class, never too old to be young.
No, truly.
You can't attend until you've seen the light and gone through cleansing. This is the one true church, pilgrim, not like those traps of Satan, those foul pits of iniquity that call themselves churches to lure the unwary into idolatry and other abominations. You can't walk in to kill a couple hours out of the rain. You gotta be saved first. In fact, uh-oh, camera warning.
Lights were blinking in each corner of the great hall.
And Jugs got him done to a turn. Now you'll see action.
The snake dance gained recruits, while the few left seated clapped cadence and bounced up and down. Ushers hurried to pick up the fallen, some of whom, mostly women, were writhing and foaming. These they dumped at the altar and left to flop like fish. Boone pointed his cigar at a gaunt redhead, about 40, whose dress was badly torn.
See that woman? It has been fully a year since she has gone through a service without being possessed by the Spirit. Sometimes Archangel Foster uses her mouth to talk to us. When that happens, it takes four husky acolytes to hold her down. She could go to heaven any time. She's ready. Anybody need a refill? Bar service is slow once the cameras are on and things get lively.
Mike let his glass be replenished. He shared none of Jill's disgust with the scene. He had been deeply troubled when he discovered that the old one was mere spoiled food. But he tabled that matter and was drinking deep of the frenzy below. It was so Martian in flavor, and he felt both homesick and warmly at home. No detail was Martian. All was wildly different. Yet he grokked a growing closer as real as water ceremony, in numbers and intensity, that he had never met outside his own nest. He wished forlornly that someone would invite him to join that jumping up and down. His feet tingled with an urge to merge with them. He spotted Miss Dawn Ardent. Perhaps she would invite him. He did not have to recognize her by size and proportions, even though she was exactly as tall as his brother Jill, with almost the same shapings. But Miss Dawn Ardent had her own face, her pains and sorrows and growings graved on it under her warm smile. He wondered if Miss Dawn Ardent might someday be willing to share water. Senator Bishop Boone made him feel wary, and he was glad that Jubal had not seated them side by side. But he was sorry that Miss Dawn Ardent had been sent away. Miss Dawn Ardent did not look up. The procession carried her away. The man on the platform raised both arms. The great cave became quieter. Suddenly he brought them down.
Who's happy?
We're happy.
Why?
God loves us.
How do you know?
Foster told us.
He dropped to his knees, raised one fist.
Let's hear that lion roar.
They roared and shrieked and screamed while he used his fist as a baton, raising the volume, lowering it, squeezing it to subvocal growl, then driving it to crescendo that shook the balcony. Mike wallowed in it, with ecstasy so painful that he feared he must withdraw. But Jill had told him that he must not, except in his own room. He controlled it and let the waves wash over him. The man stood up.
Our first hymn, he said briskly, is sponsored by Manna Bakeries, makers of Angel Bread, the loaf of love, with our Supreme Bishop's smiling face on every wrapper and containing a valuable premium coupon redeemable at your nearest neighborhood Church of the New Revelation. Brothers and sisters, tomorrow Manna Bakeries, with branches throughout the land, start a giant price-slashing sale of pre-Equinox goodies. Send your child to school with a bulging box of Archangel Foster cookies, each one blessed and wrapped in an appropriate text. And pray that each goodie he gives away may lead a child of sinners nearer to the light.
And now, let's live it up with the holy words of that old favorite, Forward Foster's Children, all together. Forward Foster's Children, smash apart your foes. Faith our shield and armor, strike them down by rows. Second verse, make no peace with sinners, God is on our side.
Mike was so joyed that he did not try to grok words. He grokked that words were not of essence. He was a growing closer. The dance started moving again, marchers chanting potent sounds with the choir. After the hymn, there were announcements, heavenly messages, another commercial, and awarding of door prizes. A second hymn. Happy Faces Uplifted was sponsored by Datelbaum's department stores, where the saved shop in safety, since no merchandise is offered which competes with a sponsored brand. A children's happy room in each branch, supervised by a saved sister. The priest moved to the front of the platform and cupped his ear.
We want Digby!
Who?
We want Digby!
Louder, make him hear you.
We want Digby!
Clap, clap, stomp, stomp.
We want Digby!
Clap, clap, stomp, stomp. It went on and on until the building rocked. Jubal leaned to Boone.
Much of that, and you'll do what Samson did.
Never fear, Boone told him around his cigar. Reinforced, sustained by faith. It's built to shake. Designed that way.
Helps.
Lights went down. Curtains parted. A blinding radiance picked out the Supreme Bishop, waving clasped hands over his head and smiling at them. They answered with the lion's roar, and he threw them kisses. On his way to the pulpit, he stopped, raised one of the possessed women, still writhing slowly, kissed her, lowered her gently, started on, stopped and knelt by the bony redhead. He reached behind him, and a microphone was placed in his hand. He put an arm around her shoulders, placed the pickup near her lips. Mike could not understand her words. He did not think they were English. The Supreme Bishop translated, interjecting it at each pause in the foaming spate.
Archangel Foster is with us. He is pleased with you. Kiss the sister on your right. Archangel Foster loves you. Kiss the sister on your left. He has a message for one of you.
The woman spoke again. Digby hesitated.
What was that? Louder, I pray you.
She muttered and screamed. Digby looked up and smiled.
His message is for a pilgrim from another planet. Valentine Michael Smith, the man from Mars. Where are you, Valentine Michael? Stand up.
Jill tried to stop him, but Jubal growled.
Easier not to fight it. Let him stand. Wave, Mike. Sit down.
Mike did so, amazed that they were now chanting,
Man from Mars! Man from Mars!
The sermon seemed to be directed at him, too, but he could not understand it.